There's probably a little bit too much fuss made about scores.
I think I'm a farmer deep down at heart. I wanted a family endeavor.
It's not about what someone else says. It's not about what rating it got. It's about what you enjoy drinking.
Wine to start with is something that is social.
It's about networking. It's about calling up people and ask for advice. And everybody's willing to help out.
Consumer wants something that's uncomplicated about wine. Why do you want one more thing to worry about?
I would trade this for nothing. It is my life and it is my dream.
You know, you only get to make one wine a year. It's not very much. I've been making wine most of my adult life, you know. It's only 35 Cabernets. I don't think that's a lot. I'm up for more.
We say, so drink the wine. That's kind of our motto here at Life Between the Vines. One of the cool things about wine, besides drinking it, is the people you drink it with. And the stories you hear and tell with wine all come together to make every bottle unique. Discovering and tasting wine shouldn't be a homework assignment. And we believe that the people who are closest to wine have the best stories. So open a bottle. And welcome to our 61st podcast, June 2012. This program features Jeff Meyer, Director of Winemaking for J. Lohr in San Jose.
As you may have guessed by now, you can find wineries all over California, even in San Jose, the home of J. Lohr Wines. J. Lohr's Jeff Meyer is a man of many hats, as he is the director of winemaking, vice president, and COO, keeping him out of the vineyard more than he would prefer. It's also worth mentioning that J. Lohr has a tasting room in Paso Robles. After recovering from a challenging 2011 harvest, Jeff took time from his busy schedule to talk with us in February by phone. I am here with Jeff Meyer, and Jeff has a lot of titles, so I'm going to go through them. He's the executive vice president. He's the chief operating officer, but probably most important, I'm going to guess, you're the director of winemaking at J. Lohr Vineyards, correct?
That is correct. Unfortunately, with the number of years I've been with Jerry, I've had to move kind of to the dark side of the business, you know, the business side, as well as still sort of overseeing all the winemaking here at the winery.
Dark side meaning that you're stuck in the office, but I still get the impression you get out in the vineyards, right?
Absolutely. The dark side is just the business side of the business. We kind of think of ourselves as winemakers as sort of being totally beholden to our palate and taste and those sorts of things, but I've also got to pay attention to the business side of the winery as well.
That's going to be tough. Winemaking is very demanding, especially, of course, you've got harvest and all that, but, you know, in these positions, I'm sure you're spending a lot of time at a desk. You've got to be working a heck of a lot of hours.
It is. It's a lot of hours. It's a lot of concentration. There's not a lot of idle time anymore. I know a lot of my friends have kind of asked me, you know, when's your downtime? And for a lot of folks in the industry, particularly on the winemaking side, you do have these slow periods early in the new year and so on when wines are just sort of aging in barrels and whatnot. But for us, it's just a constant flurry of activity. So, yeah, it's very little time for leisure, so to speak.
Whatever leisure is.
Yeah, exactly. But you know what? It's not all bad. I mean, a lot of people would shed crocodile tears for me with the work I do every day, so I don't feel so bad, quite frankly. I really enjoy what I do, and, you know, it really is a blend of art and science, and both sides of your brain are competing against one another on a daily basis.
I imagine. And you've been with J. Lohr for an awfully long time. In fact, that might come into the category of being a record, right?
Well, I've been with Jerry. This is my 28th year. It's not a record here at the winery. There's a couple of our production manager here, vice president of production and so on. A few folks have over 30 years. And in the industry, there's a few of us out there that are old timers that have been with the same organization for many years. But I think key in all of that, in a lot of respects, is a vivacious or exciting organization to work for. And we've certainly grown. We have evolved and all those things. And it just keeps it very interesting. It's never the same, I suppose, from one year to the next. Not only do you have Mother Nature giving you different fruit to work with each year, but as our business has grown and matured and we've tried to get better each year with what we do from a winemaking standpoint and trying to stay current on industry research and university research and better growing methods, better winemaking methods, all of those things have a tendency to really keep you engaged. And Jerry himself has always been very interested in trying to partner with universities or whatever so we can kind of keep abreast of the most current thinking and research and techniques and all that sort of thing for J. Lohr Winery.
So let's talk about your beginnings.
Was there a moment that you got bitten by the bug? Were you always a wine lover, and how did that happen?
You know, I think the classic thing for a lot of people from California, you go outside of the state and, you know, you meet folks. And at least when I was growing up, it was, oh, you're from California, you surf, right? It's like, well, actually, California is a big state and I don't live right next to the ocean, but I do like to go to the beach. I think, you know, growing up here in particularly Northern California, the wine industry has always sort of been there in the background. And where I grew up and my parents were sort of Midwest transplants, like so many people here in California, inevitably, if you have a family that you've left in another part of the country, they come out and visit. You got to go show them things and take them places. And inevitably, the Napa Valley or Sonoma were places that we would go, as well as cable cars in San Francisco and so on. But, you know, as a kid, I just remember always having a good experience. You know, even though I was tagging along, I couldn't consume anything. But they're always kind of beautiful locations. And I had some godparents or my brother's godparents that really kind of introduced us to wine, at, you know, at a young age, just by letting us sip things. And I thought that it was kind of interesting tasting. And then when I went to school up at Davis, although not originally intending to get into the industry, like so many of us, when you go to college, you have an idea what you want to do, but not necessarily a real idea what you want to do. And they had a very fine grape growing and wine growing, a couple of majors at the university. And I took a few classes and I saw my dad as a business person sitting behind a desk every day and so on and going into San Francisco. And for me, it just didn't seem like I wanted to be outside. I wanted to use my creative side of my brain, I suppose. And I was always a kid that tinkered and made stuff out of the cookbook during the summertime or whatever. And so when I took a few classes at Davis, I just got hooked. I realized that those people that I saw when I was a kid up in the Napa Valley were, they weren't apprentices. They actually were educated and they could apply their craft, as it were, in the industry. And so for me, it was like, wow, this is great. And fortunately, my parents said, yeah, we're willing to fund that, you know, for your education. So I was just very fortunate. So here I am, you know, 28, 29, 30 years later, still in the industry and having fun and still learning.
Did you intern at any other winery before you went to work for Jerry?
I went into selling wine for about the first 18 months. After getting out of school, I did some little intern jobs at some wineries, defunct winery in Pleasanton, where I live currently, for a harvest, and then came to work at Crush at J. Lohr in 1984, and doors just kind of continued to open here. So I've really, since that point forward, have been with the winery, but I've done Crush work, I've done construction, I ran the bottling line, I did assistant winemaker. We have a non-alcoholic brand called Ariel, which we sort of moved and operated out of the Napa Valley, out of St. Supery Winery for about 3 years in the early 90s. And then we ended up folding all that stuff back into the winery here in 95 and then was promoted to winemaker in the end of 1995, I guess. So I've been with Jerry for all those years, but it's been a very dynamic employment situation for me.
It's funny to even hear the word employment because I think a lot of us who are wine lovers don't think of it, even though that's how you make your living. There's always that passion, isn't there?
Absolutely. I mean, work is just part of what I am, or I shouldn't say work, but what I do in sort of creating wines and crafting wines and working with vineyards and so on. It's just something that's kind of all-consuming, whether I'm at home and I'm tasting wine or I'm making some food or whatever, or I'm out someplace enjoying something with friends or family. And invariably, there's a meal, there's a beverage of some sort. And for me, it's kind of, you know, how does this all work together? How is this wine made? You know, what do I like about this? What can I take away from those things? So it's just a constant sort of learning for me, even through something as simple as going out to dinner and enjoying a bottle of wine.
And I imagine that's got to change from time to time too a bit. As time goes on, maybe your palate changes a bit, or maybe your point of view changes a bit.
That's very true. You know, I think a lot of us, as you get older, you get more experience. The things, the clothes you liked as a kid or whatever the case may be. Fortunately, in most cases, those things change over time. It does happen with your palate as well. I think you have an appreciation for subtlety that maybe you didn't when you were younger and were looking more for in-your-face type flavors and those sorts of things. I think maybe subtlety is the word as we get a little bit older.
From what I recall reading about you guys, Jerry Lohr started with Cab. That was sort of the beginning of it, correct?
Jerry, back in the early 70s and in 1972 in Monterey County, his vision was a Bordeaux-style wine out of Monterey. And so some of the first planting was Cabernet Merlot, but he also planted about 9 other varietals in Greenfield, in what's now the Arroyo Seco Appellation. And unfortunately, like so many things, when you're not necessarily a pioneer, but an early entrant into a given area, is just the knowledge about the weather and some of those things are not super well known. And so, unfortunately, Monterey was just much, much colder than a lot of the temperature data would indicate, or the heat summation units and that sort of thing. And Merlot never set a crop because it was too windy there. But much to Jerry's credit, when he saw that some things were not working very well, he also saw some other varietals that were excelling, such as Chardonnay, Pinot Blanc, or what we later found out to be Melon de Bourgogne, Riesling, and what we thought was Gamay Noir from Beaujolais, which we now call Val de Guier. Those 4 varietals really excelled, and so he butted over all of that original planting, which was about 180 acres, later became 280, but it became from 11 varietals down to 4, and then subsequent we've lost Pinot Blanc as a variety and have added Pinot Noir. But it's one of those things, as I said, when you're an early adopter into a given environment, you sort of have to get the experience, I suppose, to really figure out what works well in a given area or appellation. And then if you have some things you think are mistakes, the best thing you can do is just correct those. And, you know, much to Jerry's credit, he did just that.
Those mistakes can obviously be expensive, but like anything else, that's the only way you're going to learn in the wine business, right?
That's exactly right. And, you know, unlike cooking, where you can go out and source your ingredients every day and experiment around, with wine, unfortunately, you have one season. So the time to learn, it takes a little bit longer, but you know, ultimately you need to sort of do that same evaluation though. And you know, even from a winemaking standpoint, there's certain things that work for certain varietals that doesn't work for others, and so it's just kind of a continual honing of your craft, both from the growing side and from, you know, the winemaking side.
Well, would you agree it's true? A lot of people say the more you learn about wine, the more you don't know.
Yeah, I think
maybe that applies more to the drinkers than it does to the winemakers.
Yeah, I know there's a song by Don Henley. It's, you know, the more I know, the less I understand. And I think for me, it's very true. I mean, I think that's maybe enlightenment, you know, for an individual, is when you realize how much you really don't know. And the other statement is, you know, a PhD knows everything about nothing and a manager knows nothing about everything. And for me, from the winemaking standpoint, the more you get into it, the more you realize, you know, there's just a myriad of things that you can do in the whole process of making wine, from how you grow your fruit to your cooperage choices to how you press to, you know, there's many, 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 many things you can do as a winemaker to impact the quality of the wine you produce. And a lot of it is, you know, personal style, and it's as you said, it's maturity, it's experience, and all those things kind of come into play as you hone your craft. And if you're successful, you're likely to still be working in the industry. And if not, it may not be. So.
Yeah, that's the risks that go along with taking that kind of endeavor. About how many cases do you guys do at Gillar?
We are over 1 million cases now.
Wow, I didn't realize it was that high. Wow.
Yeah.
And you obviously do several varietals at this point.
We do. We do, on the white side, really 3 varietals, Chardonnay, Riesling, and Sauvignon Blanc. And then on the red, we sort of cover the Bordeaux varietals plus Syrah, and then the obscure varietal, Val de Guier, which is kind of that Beaujolais red wine.
Yeah, I was going to actually go there for a minute. Obscure, I'm not familiar with that. You also kind of caught me with Gamay Noir.
Yeah. You know, it's one of the quirky things or the interesting things. Somehow in that original planting that Jerry did in Monterey in the early 1970s, and it could be that his partner at that time, who was French-Canadian, individual by the name of Bernie Turgeon, had Jerry plant as one of the varietals, what everyone actually had called Napa Gamay, but the presumption by the industry was that was the Gamay Noir from Beaujolais. And why they ever chose that particular varietal for Monterey, I don't really know, but it has turned out to be a stellar example of a very fruity, soft tannin red wine that is very reminiscent of the great wines of Beaujolais, to the point where we're recognized for it. But it sort of is funny now with the popularity of some of the sweeter red blends and so on that are out that have sort of made a splash in the red wine community around the country that in a lot of ways this varietal Valdiguier that we've produced for many, many years kind of fits perfectly in that same style of something fruity, soft, maybe a little sweet or, you know, has a sweet sensation on the palate for a red wine. And it's been a wine we've won best of show many times and that sort of thing. But it's just one tiny piece of what we do as a winery.
Well, sure, especially when you're doing a million cases. One thing about the name, it does make it a little bit more bromantic, doesn't it? Because it is a little more esoteric sounding.
It definitely is. Yeah, and it's not the most user-friendly name either.
No, I was going to. Where's the operation located?
Well, our original winery is still here in San Jose, south of San Francisco, about an hour's drive. We produce all of our white wines here, and we do all of our bottling and case goods warehousing. And then we have a winery, our red wine facility in Paso Robles, which is about 2.5 hours south of where we are here in San Jose. And that's really kind of where our center of gravity for production has sort of, or for winemaking has really shifted. About 2/3 of our wines we produce are red varietals, the largest being Cabernet Sauvignon. And then here in San Jose, that other third is largely Chardonnay, but some Riesling and Sauvignon Blanc, as I mentioned earlier.
And I want to say before I forget my compliments on your Pinot Noir, I got to try it a little while ago. I haven't tried your Cabernet yet, and I'm not the biggest Pinot guy in the world, but I really liked what you guys make.
Was that the Fox Reach Pinot?
Yes, it was.
Okay. Yeah, that was Pinot Noir for Jerry was one of those varietals he tried and planted in the early 1970s. And it was actually, again, it's sort of a timing thing, but a lot of Pinot Noir that was available in the early 70s in California was either champagne stock or it was virus or had some other issues. And then it was also grown like Cabernet in a lot of cases with sort of that old Napa Valley sprawl, kind of looked more like a bush instead of an upright, vertically trained vine, which is kind of how Pinot Noir is really grown in California now. The winery, we actually butted over Pinot Noir to Chardonnay back in the late 1970s, and I pretty much had talked to Jerry about it being that environment in the Arroyo Seco in Monterey is nice and cool. Chardonnay does really well there. And I had talked to Jerry a few times that I thought Pinot could do very well in Monterey, but those early experiences with it, and he wasn't too excited, at least in the mid-80s with that. And then a lot of new clonal material became available from Dijon and from the French Antav INRA down in Montpellier. So we tasted some clones of Pinot Noir from a neighbor of ours. We're really excited about it. And after almost 20 years since Jerry's first experience with Pinot, we ended up planting 27 acres in the Arroyo Seco of different clones and different rootstocks. And we also had to build a winery basically within our winery in Paso Robles for handling Pinot Noir, because it really is different grape to work with than Cabernet. And you need to be much gentler. You really need to keep oxygen away from the fruit and all those sorts of things. So it was a completely new thought process that went into Pinot. And I think doing all those things and taking all those steps has really benefited the Pinot Noir that we've been able to produce, particularly the Fog's Reach Pinot Noir.
Yeah, I like the name, too. Do you still get a chance to spend, considering all these hats you're wearing, do you spend a lot of time in the vineyards these days?
I do. I'm very involved when it comes to farming. We meet and put a farm plan together every year for the various vineyards and blocks. We talk about the results from the prior year or years and, you know, how we did and what changes, if any, we need to make and those sorts of things. So we kind of collectively as a vineyard and winemaking team sort of decide on our strategy for pruning and any special farming techniques that we may want to do. And then during the course of the year, I try to visit and get out and look at the vineyard kind of at the various stages of growth from pruning time, bud break, flowering and set time of year. And then over the course of the summer, we spend a fair amount of time out in the vineyard kind of looking at water status and what's going on in the vineyards in the season, assessing potential issues, crop size, and all those sorts of things that are going to impact the winery and ultimately the quality of the wines are set by the fruit in the vineyard. So it's really important for us on the winemaking side to be able to spend that time in the vineyard, as well as if we develop a property with a new planting or go into replanting. Winemaking is very, very involved in that because, again, it's so critical to really match your varieties that you plant and rootstocks and so on with the site, and the site being the soil types and the microclimate in that given area and slope and aspect and all those sorts of things. So we're pretty involved, and the only issue I have is as the years have gone by, I don't have any more room for hair follicles in my head, so the sunburn is a real issue when it comes to spending so much time outdoors out here. So I have to wear one additional hat, as it were, while I'm out sort of visiting vineyards and whatnot.
Sure. Our goal at Life Between the Vines is to make wine less scary. Sometimes people go into a tasting room, they're intimidated by it. They go into a store, they're intimidated by it. Pricing, of course, as we well know, can be intimidating. But in a nutshell, how would you see a way that you could describe to the average wine buyer why wine shouldn't be scary?
There's a poster that I saw when my kids were in grade school, particularly when they just started kindergarten. And it had a picture of a little kid who had a bat and a glove, and he was looking out on a field of players. And the caption on the picture was, "The expert at anything was once a beginner." And I think it's something that really rings true when it comes to wine. I mean, I've been in this industry for many, many years now, but I started out as a beginner. And I think for most people, the real thing about wine is don't be afraid to try things. Don't let somebody else tell you what you should like, I suppose. If something attracts your eye, or if some friends tell you something, or you're somewhere and you try something that you like, let your taste buds be your guide. And the scores and those sorts of things don't necessarily tell the whole story for everyone. And I would just encourage people to experiment, you know. If you're spending $5 to $15 on occasion for a bottle of wine or whatever, and it disappoints you a little bit, well, take it as just an experience. But for the most part, I think we all, depending on the situation, will find some enjoyment out of that experimenting. And that's the big thing for me, you know. And if you find that you don't like wines that are overly tannic, then talk to the wine steward in the grocery store or the wine shop or wherever you purchase the wine at, and use them as a resource, because a lot of times they can really help you a little bit in trying to decide maybe where to direct you for wines that might be of interest to you. But I think the biggest thing is don't be afraid to experiment. Enjoy stuff with your friends and talk about those things. The thing that we used to do a lot, which was a lot of fun, was just get together and maybe pick a variety that, you know, you and several of your friends might be interested in, and everybody bring a bottle and put them in brown bags and pop the corks out and pour them for everybody and rate them 1 to 8 or whatever the case may be. And you'd be surprised sometimes with the results that come out of a tasting like that. Have fun with it. I mean, it's really what it's meant to be. And if you enjoy wine, you know, the journey can start at any time. My brother was quite intimidated because I've been in this industry for so long that he kind of gravitated toward beer for many, many years. And then in the last 10 years, he's really started to enjoy wine a lot. And it doesn't have to be something pretentious. That'd be my advice, is just don't be afraid to experiment.
Excellent. That's a really great answer. I appreciate that, because that's exactly what I was looking for.
Sure.
Jeff, most importantly, if our listeners would like to learn more about J. Lohr Vineyards, how would they find out about you guys?
Well, we're certainly available on the web. You really don't even have to go to a website. If you go to Google or whatever your search engine is on your computer, you can type in J. Lohr, and it'll eventually lead you to www.jlohr.com, and that's JLOHR.com. Click on the link, and you can find out about our vineyards, our wines, our wine clubs, tasting notes, recipes, food pairings, all those sorts of things that you may or may not want to know about J. Lohr Vineyards and Wines.
That's great. Jeff, thanks for taking the time. I know you're busy and there's a lot going on out there, so thanks very much and take care.
Okay, Ray, thank you very much.
Visit Jeff on the web at jlohr.com. Thank you for listening to this podcast. Watch for our next program, which is a special, coming to you direct from Auction Napa Valley 2012. Life Between the Vines was produced by Ray Pfister. Post-production was completed at Fifth Floor Recording Company, Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Edited by Ray Pfister and our intern, Bob Warner. Original music composed by Tim Turton. Narrated by Kay Paskoff. Web design by Jenny Holland. Our web geek is Tim Panicucci.
Photography by Jeanette Herniak. Copyright 2012.